Just wanted to say thank you to all who contributed during our winter membership drive. It was the first drive of our centennial year. We had over 3,000 listeners pledge. We had 625 new members. That's wonderful. And wow, look at the amount. You donated more than $450,000. And that, you know, that's what builds a strong today, tomorrow, and the next 100 years for Wisconsin Public Radio, for the programs that you love. And we really thank you so much for helping us out. And we're right on with our programming. And last Monday of the month, the weather guys come by. Well, I got the weather, one of the weather guys, the guy with me.
The guy.
Now, Steve Ackerman. Oh, man. Steve is director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW-Madison, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be back here on this short month.
Yeah, this short month. John will be joining us in about 10 minutes or so. He's finishing up with his class.
And yep, and then he runs all the way through campus, all the way across campus.
And comes breathless to the show. Well, I tell you what, this weather has been on everybody's agenda, I think, for the last week or so. Let's start with the warm weather.
Yeah, that was this
60s
last...
and 70s in the southern part of the state.
Yeah, we hit our all-time maximum temperature for winter. That's including December, January, and February. That warm spell that we had then moved to the East Coast, and there were thousands of record-high temperatures broken during that one-week period. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and we had thunderstorms.
Thunderstorms, yep. There was a tornado in Maryland on Saturday as well, so we're... You know, now talking about will tornado season start early in the southeast and the southern parts of the state anyway, because there's a lot of moisture down there and things are warming up. The Gulf Stream really didn't get any cold air. The Gulf of Mexico didn't get any real cold air, so that water is nice and warm. It's going to be an interesting spring, I think.
Yeah. Betsy in River Falls has something I think that relates right to this. Let's go there. Betsy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much. I wonder when climate change and actual local weather begin to sort of merge more than we have thought possible. I mean, is this sort of the beginning of climate change sticking its ugly little head into our nice old Wisconsin weather and world weather? And should we, you know, start drinking more brandy and worry about
it? Well, we're not going to have those cold winters, so maybe we won't drink as much brandy. But.
Okay.
But yeah, the you know, the overall trends in warming that we've seen in Wisconsin, not just the daytime maximums, but the nighttime maximums, it's those nighttime temperatures that have really been warming up. We're just not as cold as we used to be. So yeah, there's no doubt that that's influencing the temperature and other patterns across the U.S. and the globe. The interesting thing now is that and that's easy to see statistically. What's becoming more interesting and a lot more studies looking at is our extreme weather events. You know, so when you get a lot of severe thunderstorms or heavy rains, and, you know, what is that coupling to a warmer atmosphere due to the global warming? So that's where a lot of interesting work is occurring right now, I think, in terms of research.
Are we doing some work here?
Thank you.
Yeah, John's looking at some in terms of the location of where the jet stream is. And a lot of times severe weather follows where the jet stream is. We had a guy in our group in Sims, the NOAA employee, looking at hurricane intensifications as well. So, yeah, we're doing some work here for sure.
Kathy in La Crosse has something for us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I've been chronically trying to move to Eugene, Oregon all winter, and I was hearing about these jet stream rivers of moisture out on the coast. I'm wondering a couple of things. Is this do you see this calming down so I can get out of here soon? And I was also wondering if you happen to know, since I can't remember which of the guys this was that lived out on the coast there, I mean, is this something where I'm going to need to look at getting long-term flood insurance? Is Eugene situated okay so I don't have to worry maybe as much about it? Or
I think Eugene's probably not so bad because it's east of east of one of the Rocky Ranges, right? The mountain ranges there.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, so yep. Usually when you're downwind of the mountain ranges, you're generally drier.
So it's kind of like San Jose in the, between the in Northern California. I lived in Northern California in San Jose, which just totally flooded out. And does Eugene get a lot of usually get a lot of the same systems that the Bay Area or Northern Cali at least gets? Or
well,
no?
You know, it's a different system, but still with flooding, they could get flooded by heavy precipitation coupled with snowmelt. So I know there's a river that runs right through Eugene, right? So you,
yeah.
If you're, I mean, so we live, you know, we don't live in a floodplain, but we live close to a shoreline, and so we don't have to get flood insurance, but we get it anyway because.
Does it look like it's going to calm down soon, or can't you tell at all?
It's probably going to calm down as the season changes, but yeah, they've been getting a lot of precipitation. Because of this flow of atmospheric water vapor that just runs right into the mountains, and then the mountains lift it, and boom, you get lots of precipitation.
Are you still seeing that? And do you get like satellite projections to kind of give you an idea if that's going to continue or not really?
Yeah, actually, this one thing we can really monitor well is what we call this atmospheric river. So the moisture that's hitting the West Coast, we could actually. And there's a group here in Wisconsin that has developed the analysis tools to look at that, and so that's heavily relied on in predicting it.
Where would Kathy go to, say, online or wherever to just sort of look more into detail at those patterns?
I would search on atmospheric rivers flooding. And that'll probably give you a variety of sites, you know, some explained in more non-science language and then others more deeply in science language as well.
And then maybe I could go on the NOAA website and look at maybe some of the projections. They might have some projections up there.
Yep. Yeah, I would go to the NOAA CPC, the Climate Prediction Center. They always do these forecasts for the country, but for the West Coast, they do some nice forecasting, particularly with regard to this flooding that's been going on.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you so much. I appreciate still being in La Crosse to get a chance to talk to you again, but I'm sure wanting to go.
Yes, stay in Wisconsin.
Stay here. Right. Stay here, Kathy. Right. If you must go.
It's getting warmer.
Yeah, it's getting warmer. Oh, boy. Thanks again. Ron in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hey, guys. You know, the fake news does a good job of keeping us up to date on what's going on in our country with bizarre weather. Is this happening around the world, too, like in Africa, China, India?
Yes, except, all right, I'm going to forget the region. I was just reading about this, and I forget if it's Asia or, you know, east of China or west of China, but they're cold. What's the pattern that we've got set up that really gave us our warm weather is kind of a shifted pattern that gave us our cold weather in like 2012. You remember we had that really cold winter?
Yeah.
In that cold winter, the jet stream was set up so that it was pulling cold Canadian air right down our way. And now that trough, the way that the jet stream is set up, is to the west of us. And so we're set up right now where the conditions in the atmosphere are pulling warm air to the south of us up. So usually when some area is abnormally warm, there's an area that is abnormally cold on the other side of the globe.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, I just wanted to let you know that the fake news comment was made in jest.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We, you know, it's really sad when real news is now called fake news,
You worried me when you didn't laugh.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm getting depressed that the New York Times and CNN and Washington Post are called fake news because, you know, they're the standard of critical analysis.
Thanks, Ron, for calling. Appreciate it. Kenneth called to ask if this variation of temperatures in a short period of time is what we should expect with climate changes?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to say not necessarily in terms of getting the rapid changes, because these rapid changes are generally associated with like fronts going by or other weather systems. And while those average temperature may be going up, the gradients, the differences between a daytime high and the next day's cold because the cold front moves through may not change that much. But that's an interesting question. We should have somebody look at that. What's happening to the Delta T's?
Clinton, Nina, thanks for calling.
Hi. I was calling because, I was able to, through the convenience of Twitter, speak with, communicate with Scott Bachmeyer about some satellite images.
Oh, yeah.
I have a problem in terms of getting a hold of the actual image from the, from the early data. So, basically, when I come on in the evening, the data on the MODIS Today site shows me the overlaid image from the second pass of the satellite over the planet. And I can't get a hold of the earlier imagery. So the overlay sometimes is a little fuzzy.
Yep.
And the earlier one is usually clearer or can be clearer at times. So I'm wondering if you know how to get a hold of that 250-meter resolution imagery.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you my email, and then you can send me an email and inquiry, and I can send you the link.
Okay.
Where we have, because we do, I know we have those online, and I think it's open to the public. It's not local. So my email is steve@ssec.wisc.edu.
Okay.
And Bach's a great, Scott Bachmeyer is a great guy to talk to. He is a person in our group who is nationally recognized for his analysis of satellite data, and he's also a great Twitterer. Is that he's got that sense of humor, you know, that you can put in 142 characters.
There we go. Clint, thanks a lot for calling. Steve Ackerman, our guest right now. John Martin will soon be here, and we'll talk more weather and climate with the both of them right after we take a look at the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at weather and climate right now with our two guests, Larry Mueller here. John Martin just joined us, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here.
Steve Ackerman is the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and also a member of the same department as John in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, thank you for coming as well, again.
Yeah, it's great to be here, representing the greatest department on campus.
He's got that right.
That's one thing we can agree on. There's two of us, two out of three.
We agree on a lot, but that is primary.
Well, I tell you what, as you're listening to these two characters, you can join in with your own weather and climate question. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. So give a call, shoot us an email, go to our Facebook page. And by the way, if you have some weather photos, cloud photos, we love those photos. Post them up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I haven't checked yet. I'll check right now to see if we've got some already, but if you haven't gotten one up there yet, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post one. Carol emailed to ask if rain gauges are made in a certain ratio of height to diameter, or can any straight-sided vessel work?
So I think the key is there are standard rain gauges that you can use, and actually measuring rain is actually pretty hard. Not as hard as snow, but it's pretty hard. And so if you can get a calibrated one, you know, one where, that tells you when this much comes in, there was an actually inch of rainfall, you could probably make your own, and there's probably not much of a concern of the width to height, actually. I'm not sure.
Yeah, not the width probably, to height, but just the, I guess the width. You got to know how much cross-sectional area you're covering. Yeah.
So why is it hard to make a rain gauge?
You know, if it's a nice steady rain that just falls straight down, then it's going to fall right into that cylinder. But if it's blowing to the side, or if you have the cylinder too close to something, you know, the raindrops can bounce off of that and end up in your rain gauge. It's kind of an interesting way to try and collect it and collect it accurately.
Yeah. It's not easy. Yeah.
And most people want to have it right next to their window or something.
Yeah, so you could look outside.
Yeah, and maybe there's a tree in the neighbor's yard that's dripping, you know, water off it after the rain's over, and you collect a few more drops or something. It's just, it's not easy.
Yeah, it's running right off the roof. Where I know there's when I was in Colorado, I was talking to the state climatologist there, and he was monitoring. In fact, he's the guy who started Kokoros, for those who
are in it.
Yeah. And then he noticed someone in Grand Junction, the precipitation there just all of a sudden went up, and it stayed high. And he was just like, what the heck's going on in here? So he got in his car, drove out there. And, you know, the rain gauge was still in the place where it was, where you want to keep it away from obstructions and in the field. But right next to it, somebody put a big garbage dump. So the rain was just splattering off the hood and coming back into the rain gauge.
So, well, there you are.
There you are. It really depends on where you put it.
You've got to be careful.
Oh, man. Well, listen, what about the lakes? What's going on with the ice on the Great Lakes?
So the ice on the Great Lakes is really low this year.
Yeah.
I looked a couple of weeks ago, and I think Superior had 4%, and Michigan had 0.1%.
Yeah, or 10%, you mean?
No, 0.1%.
Of?
Yeah, it was just really small
amazing.
Amounts. I mean, it was pretty much the bay with
boy,
it was
oh
full.
Boy, it's amazing.
And our lakes are high. I mean, the water level on Lake Mendota is in summer level range. I mean, it's really kind of surprised. Yeah.
And the ice is docked now. There's still ice on Mendota, right?
Yeah, there is.
But,
yeah, it's starting to melt.
It looks
away.
Like, I bet from space, it looks like it's not there.
Yeah.
And so it's going to, day like today even, it'll take some more out.
Get a windy day.
That's all it's going to take now.
Yeah.
Yep.
Monona, Lake Monona is opened up in a couple of different spots, and you know that it won't be long, just a really good wind.
Yep.
Yeah. And now's the time if it's calm. I mean, ice is fascinating, and I was talking with this with one of our engineers. If you have a boat to go out to the ice edge, because if it's still calm, you can get these really odd ice crystalline structures in terms of how it forms. And they're just like cylinders in a hexagonal shape. But as soon as you touch them, they just...
They're like those things that Superman had at his Fortress of Solitude.
Yes, they're like, right.
Yeah. They're
except
not green.
Soft, right.
So they're actually in that form, or they're
actually in that form. And if you get any kind of wind, then I mean they're very delicate. So as long as the wind is calm, I know I took my rowboat out there once and you know went into it, and it just disintegrates, and it makes a beautiful
a great
sound.
Yeah, it almost sounds like a chandelier.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And then the next year I went out there and I stopped rowing and I went right into it, and it hadn't happened. So my wind. Man, I got a whiplash.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, let's take some more calls. You can join in. We'll get you on and pretty quickly here at Open Line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Or, again, shoot us an email at talk@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. John in Milwaukee up next. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon, Larry. And, guys, my question is, as a student pilot, what would you guys recommend, like, for a weather site to go on that would give, you know, really, really good information, you know, for the day? And
boy, that's a good question. Mm. And do you want it at the ground, or do you want it upper atmosphere where you're flying?
Obviously, you know, various ranges up until like 3,000 feet.
Yeah. So for radar, I use this thing called RadarScope. And then for the weather, I tend to use one from Weather Underground, but I don't know if that's going to give you the upper air information that you might want.
Yeah.
And I don't know if NOAA has an app for
it. I don't know if there's an app for it either. There's websites that are quite good, but so, they might not be directly to pilots. Because I know you guys would have a specific kind of, you want to have a quick lookup table or something like that. I don't know if anybody digests the information quite that way that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Certainly not in an app. It's a great question. Maybe there's just something out there that needs to be made.
Right, yeah. Or maybe there is, and some other pilot will call in.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Thanks a lot for calling. Here's a photo from Carrie, who says, I took this a few weeks ago driving from Green Bay to Wisconsin Dells. Not sure what it was. Any thoughts? And it's looking at the cloud formation.
Yeah, it looks to me like a sundog.
Yeah.
So you get, when you get the cirrus clouds up there, ice crystal clouds, to the left and the right, or sometimes it's just one side of the sun, right at the same altitude, you'll see this bright spot, and it'll have color to it. And that is just the light rays that if that cloud weren't there, that would have went off to somebody in Colorado to see.
Yeah.
But it hits the ice crystal and it gets bent, just like the crystal prisms that we hang up in our windows. And gets bent your way, and then you see it.
Yep.
So if you want to know what a sundog looks like, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, look under Carrie's message, and there's a nice photo of one. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Let's go to Scott in Madison next. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I have been watching my weather webpage, and I've noticed this winter, although I wouldn't have needed a webpage for it, but I've noticed this winter that every single time, almost every time, moisture comes into the air, precipitation comes, the temperature goes up above freezing this winter, and then as soon as the rain stops, the temperature drops below freezing.
Yeah.
And then we've seen this pattern over and over again, which is frustrating because I'm a cross-country skier. So is this just a fluke this year, or do you think it's part of a pattern that we're going to start, that we're going to enter now? We're going to have this kind of winter every year?
No, the tendency for the temperature to rise on the onset of precipitation is fundamental to the way the mid-latitude weather works, because it's controlled. Our weather, not our weather, but our precipitation is controlled, especially in the wintertime, by what are known as mid-latitude cyclones that have a counterclockwise circulation around them. So, and all the clouds and precipitation is always on the eastern side of these disturbances where the flow is coming from the south. So it's almost inescapable that you're going to have a temperature rise when the precipitation comes in and a temperature drop on the western side of a counterclockwise rotating air mass, which will be dragging colder air from north of you in its wake. So that's almost always the case. Whether or not we'll have temperatures, the temperature rise will bring us above freezing and then cause snow to turn to rain. That could be something that's going on long term. I think this year was just kind of fluky, though, because we've had plenty of winters in the recent past where that hasn't been much of a deal. I grew up in New England, and we have this concrete, ugly snow that if you've seen Manchester by the Sea at the movies, when that guy is shoveling that snow, that's exact. I can tell you, I remember that snow. And we got that this winter in Dane County. We don't usually get it, but it's relatively unusual for us to have that mix of rain and snow that we've kind of had more than once.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Richard in Madison, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great, appreciate the call.
Sure. I take my canoe or kayak, mostly kayak lately, out onto Lake Mendo or Monona. I would say it's been an annual event for me for the last 6-7 years where I go out when the ice is just breaking up, and just like what you were talking about, it forms that crystalline structure, and you can kind of bust through it with your kayak and dig your paddle in and flip the ice across the rest of the ice sheet, and it sounds exactly like crystal chandeliers.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just a beautiful, beautiful experience. But what I'm wondering is what causes the ice to form those hexagonal crystals, if you have any idea about that.
Yeah, so it's a complex process. But what it has to do with is that when water freezes, particularly in the natural world, not in the lab, it usually starts around a nucleus. So it's really hard to get absolutely pure water to freeze. In fact, you can only do that when you get to like minus 40.
Yeah,
if it's really calm and still and absolutely pure, it's got to get really cold. But if you have nuclei sites in there, then when the temperature gets, you know, to 32, then they can activate the freezing. And then once they start, everything begins. So that crystalline structure is where the ice is initially starting to form. And then when things begin to warm up and it starts to melt, that crystal, that nuclei that caused the ice falls back out into the water. And so you just have the ice crystal there. So it's a complex problem, but it's fascinating.
Is there convection, too, that kind of eats away at the bottom side of the ice?
Yes, right. So it's melting from the bottom and that's where it would have started, and then it grows up.
Yeah, really interesting.
So it's melting from the bottom, because sometimes the crystals, if you get a really good one, they can be 5-6 inches long.
Yeah. You can collect them at James Madison Park with ease. When the big sheets of ice come up around this time of year, sometimes you can see the whole underside of these collections of these crystals, and you can pull them off. They're really spectacular.
Yeah, so the freeze starts right at the surface and then works its way down as the winter goes on.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Emmanuel in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling in response primarily to the student pilot who just called in.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens I'm a licensed private pilot and a certificated ground instructor. And the short answer, if there is one, to his question is that there are a couple of apps out there that are, one I believe is actually approved by the FAA for obtaining weather information both on the ground and in the air. One is called ForeFlight, and Garmin also makes an app called Garmin Pilot that has a weather feature. However, I would stress that weather information for flying purposes has to come from approved sources. There are a couple of websites that are FAA approved at this time. One is duat.com, and the second one is duats.com. And the government, NOAA specifically, has an aviation drop-down menu that also produces aviation-specific weather products. And more guidance on that can actually be obtained from an FAA handbook that is available for free as a PDF on the FAA website called Aviation Weather Services.
Yeah, that's great information.
It sure
right,
is.
To use the expert. I know we were talking, we were working with one of the airplane manufacturers, and they were looking at, for big jets, how to get weather data, particularly satellite data, into the cockpit. And one of the stories they were telling at one of these conferences is that, you know, private personal pilots were bringing iPads in. And so they were approaching, you know, a line of thunderstorms or something, and then they would fire up their radar app, non-approved by the FAA, and then looking at it and saying, oh, I can make it right through this gap of the precipitation. So they would shoot for it, and they wouldn't realize that satellite image was 10, 15 minutes, or that radar image was 10 or 15 minutes old. And so oftentimes they would fly right into the convective core of the storm.
That's exactly right, unfortunately. Yeah,
right.
I'll also add that one of the additions that is coming to the National Airspace System is the so-called ADS-B device that will become mandatory, actually, for general aviation as well in the next couple of years, which essentially pipes in approved weather data via apps. But again, there will be some delay as far as imagery, and it's actually against the Federal Aviation Regulations to fly anywhere near, or I should say within a minimum 20-mile radius of any storm.
Yeah, there we go. Emmanuel, thank you so much.
That's great to know.
Welcome.
Good
point. I appreciate it very much. Let's see. We have Jeremy in Oconomowoc up next. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. You?
Good. So I was out on my boat one day just living the life of leisure on the lake, and I looked up, and there was a large storm front, and right before it, there was a ice cream cone. It looked like a chocolate vanilla swirl, white with dark gray swirls, like the top of a swirly cone.
Hmm.
Can you please elaborate at all if you have any idea what that might be?
Man, wow.
And I'll take my answer off there. Have a great day.
Yeah. I don't know what it could be. I mean, here's some things that could fool a person when they're seeing it. It could be perspective that gives it this appearance of protruding downward, but it may not. But if it's protruding downward, it could very well be some sort of a weak funnel cloud. It's possible. But the white and gray is odd, because if it's weak, it's probably not going to have a lot of different color variations, but it's not impossible that that's the case.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, I wish you took a picture of it and send it to me.
Yeah.
I do a lot of, you know, work, research with satellites and clouds, but I'd like to also collect pictures of cloud shapes, you know, like bunnies and dragons. And,
But,
you know, to remind us that it's not always science. It's also art and beauty.
This
could have been good, a nice ice cream cone cloud.
Yeah.
That would have been cool. Well, speaking of photos, my good buddy and old friend, Kurt Westbrook, sent one in. Kurt's a great photographer.
So gorgeous.
And he worked at Channel 3 for many, many years in Madison, a film guy there. But he has this, I don't know, purplish clouds against a dark blue sky. And it's an old building, old broken down building. Is a really cool picture.
Yeah.
But wondering the clouds, if you guys could identify the clouds. In the photo, February 16th photo.
They might look like they look like I can't see the picture so well from far away, but they look like they've got a little bit of verga falling out of them. They're kind of widespread but uniformly distributed. They look like they could be altocumulus flocculus or Castellanus.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Castellanus because they get a little more tight. They get deeper.
Yeah, and you can
right?
see
yeah.
that mare's tails more obviously. Maybe yeah. they're about to transition, or maybe they're just flocculus.
Yeah.
All right, so
they're
here,
pretty.
Yeah, they're really yeah. pretty photo. Nancy sent us a photo. I took this picture on our farm in Taylor, Wisconsin, last Wednesday at sunrise when it was so weirdly warm.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's not the weird warm that gets me on this picture. It's yeah. it's gorgeous in the sense that you know it's probably half cloudy and half sky, so you can see the blue sky up above. And then where the sun is setting or rising, you're getting that really deep yellow
yeah.
or bright yellow.
Although
and
also
then the clouds
add,
are red.
Right, and I'll also add that if I weren't told that this was February and there weren't trees in the front with no leaves on them, you'd think that's a tropical sky. So
yeah.
it's not coincidental that happened on our warmest winter day ever in 15,250 of them since we've been recording them since 1870. That air was tropical.
Right. Yeah.
And so the clouds that develop within it are going to have a tropical look to them. That's and they certainly do.
Very cool.
It looks like
cool.
a travel brochure to Jamaica or something.
Well, Dave in La Crosse has a comment or a question. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. I read a couple articles a little over a year ago saying that the increased warm water around Antarctica was leading to more snowfall on East Antarctica and that was offsetting the loss of mass of ice that was thawing around the edges of Antarctica, which would result in a delaying of sea level rise. And I just wondered if there's been any new work on that subject.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I can't. What's coming to my mind is, so two things. One is the snowfall in Antarctica, even though the ice sheets are really, really thick, is generally small. It's a small amount of snow. Yeah. It just accumulates over hundreds of thousands of years.
It doesn't melt.
Right, it doesn't melt. Mm. And so the thing that I'm thinking of, there's another big iceberg that's about to break off or just broke off. And so I think when you're losing the ice sheets around Antarctica, that's coming from the plateau. So the land is actually really high around the South Pole. It's up like around 600 millibars, so
yeah,
higher than Denver. And it's that flow that's just pushing the ice out onto the ocean, and then it breaks away, and then you lost. So
yeah.
I can't imagine that it's increasing the that the net gain of ice is greater.
Right, than what you're losing by calving
losing
or whatever
the
they
calving.
Call it. Yeah,
yeah,
I don't believe so either. That seems hard to believe. Because I think it's about 4 inches a year average. And that's a year because it's cold all year round. It's 4 inches a year of snow. Four tenths of an inch of precipitation in many locations. Yeah.
Okay.
It's not that much.
I assume you'd still be losing a lot of ice mass from Greenland every year.
Yeah, they're still losing a lot. Melting and the glaciers melting that are actually on land. Because they do get below freezing, and actually we're losing a lot of ice.
Although they have a better chance up there because it's a stormier part of the world, and it's not quite as high latitude to actually replenish it with new snow, especially in southern Greenland. But I don't know if that's actually happening, but the chances are better there.
Yeah, well, our Arctic this year is really, really warm.
Yeah,
and
that's
still
right.
Really
it's actually,
warm.
In those longitudes in particular, yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And there's some more Facebook questions there, but we are out of time.
Well, rats.
Guys, thank you so much for being with us. And the last Monday of March, you'll be back.
We'll be back. Lion, out like a lamb?
Yeah, like that's correct. Yeah. March is an interesting month.
It'll be fun to talk about.
Yep.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman from the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And, boy, thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.